Welcome to the Underclass Podcast with Austin Picard. I'm an independent researcher who can't stomach being lied to on a daily basis by the mainstream media. While we live in a fracturing society, launched into parallel realities, falling perfectly onto the two sides of the political spectrum, I remain in the underclass. Today, we stagger into the heart of darkness, solemnly performing the Requiem for a Dream, as we reveal the illicit subterfuge weaponized to exploit us. It's finally time we're conscious of the malevolent machinations designed to disarm us of our essential use of discernment. In an effort to regain our intellectual fortitude, we witness the true levers of power through a perpetual national sex scandal and a lurid account of the twisted tale of two DC madams. When George Orwell was struggling to find a publisher for his famous fable Animal Farm, he prepared a statement on the topic of freedom of the press, writing that, "I know the English intelligentsia have plenty of reason for their timidity and dishonesty. Indeed, I know by heart the arguments by which they justify themselves. But at least let us have no more nonsense about defending liberty against fascism. If liberty means anything at all, it means the right to tell people what they do not want to hear." Our story begins Thursday, June 29th, 1989, when the Washington Times published an article on the front page of the newspaper with the title, "Homosexual Prostitution Inquiry Ensnares VIPs with Reagan Bush. Callboys Took Midnight Tour of White House." Within an hour, this issue of the Washington Times would be gathered up and removed from newspaper vendors all throughout Washington, D.C. Ken Adashi, editor for EducateYourself.org, suggests that it was through the unethical conduct of the Secret Service that the White House was largely responsible for having the newspapers recalled in an underhanded attempt to suppress yet another inconvenient truth.
And if Washington doesn't have enough to talk about these days, the Washington Times reported today that unidentified White House aides in the Carter, Reagan, and Bush administrations now are being investigated for using the services of a callboy ring. The paper reports that two of the male prostitutes were given a late-night tour of the White House last year. The White House Press Secretary Marlon Fitzwater said he knew nothing of this investigation. NBC's Lisa Myers reports her sources in the U.S. Attorney's Office say the investigation is not focusing on prostitution, but on fraud involving the use of credit cards to pay for the callboy services.
Sources confirmed a Washington Times report today that D.C. police and the Internal Revenue Service are investigating a male prostitution ring whose clients may have included people connected to the Bush and Reagan administrations. But the sources told CBS News there is no indication at present that the investigation involves any high government or military officials.
King's partner was Washington lobbyist Craig Spence. Spence took youngsters, including Benassi, on private midnight tours of the White House.
So you were in the White House then?
Yes.
And how did you gain access?
Well, I came down with Larry King, but Craig Spence was the one that arranged the trip for us. And it was kind of a gift for our services that we were doing.
How many times were you on this kind of a trip?
I came to it on two times.
Two times? And were you used for sex on those occasions?
Not until after we left.
After you left the White House?
Yes.
What time of night?
It was usually around midnight. For me, it was just kind of weird being in the White House at that time of the night. Getting to go into places that the guy was telling us that nobody gets to go to. And I seen rooms in there that I'd never even heard about. And Craig Spence and Larry King had a couple of groups. One was called Bodies by God, and they had the Callboys. And there was another group that was started by Larry King, which was called the Golden Boys, which was kids that were usually under the age of approximately 10.
Spencer's callboy network was investigated in 1989 by reporter Paul Rodriguez of the Washington Times.
We had uncovered a series of allegations from some minors, and it led me to a callboy operation.
It sure fits with, you know, this boy Paul Benassi, and he tells a tale of being brought to the White House on occasion kind of as a reward for the kid.
Craig Spence is dead. He committed suicide. He had advanced stages of AIDS. He was an AIDS carrier and he killed himself. This was the thing that always bothered me. They claimed it was the largest male prostitution ring in the city that they've ever had uncovered. It was $1 million a year minimum.
Yeah.
And yet they only prosecuted the operator, Henry Vinson, and three of his lieutenants, as it were. Mm-hmm. They never went after any of the Johns or the clients. This operation claimed to have clients that ran from the White House to the Capitol Hill to the State House to the churches and within the media.
Exactly what Paul describes as the people he was with.
And a lot of the stuff led there, but we couldn't quite nail it at all cases because, again, to accuse someone of high stature, you've got to be very careful.
I understand.
We were able to do it through the mother lode was provided us credit card receipts and canceled checks and then lists of the clients. The prosecutors knew all this stuff. There was approximately 20,000 documents they had. They sealed the entire record by court order. And we have tried, we've attempted on several occasions to unseal that, and we've been told it'll be a cold day in hell before those records ever get unsealed. And it makes me wonder what's in those records.
Yeah.
Barney Frank, one of two openly homosexual members of Congress, acknowledged having used a male prostitute, whom he then hired as a personal employee. The man had keys to Frank's basement apartment on Capitol Hill. Frank paid him approximately $20,000 out of his own pocket to be his housekeeper and driver. But as first reported in today's Washington Times, the man was on probation for sex crimes and a drug conviction, and he ran a prostitution business out of Frank's home.
According to this recalled 1989 article, written by Paul Rodriguez and George Archibald, a homosexual prostitution ring was under investigation by federal and district authorities. It includes among its clients key officials of the Reagan and Bush administrations, military officers, congressional aides, and U.S. and foreign businessmen with close social ties to Washington's political elite. One of the ring's high-profile clients was so well-connected, in fact, that he could arrange a middle-of-the-night tour of the White House for his friends on Sunday, July 3rd of last year. Among the six persons on the extraordinary 1 a.m. tour were two male prostitutes. Federal authorities, including the Secret Service, are investigating criminal aspects of the ring and have told male prostitutes and their homosexual clients that a grand jury will deliberate over the evidence throughout the summer. Reporters for this newspaper examined hundreds of credit card vouchers drawn on both corporate and personal cards and made payable to the escort service operated by the homosexual ring. Many of the vouchers were run through a so-called sub-merchant account of the Chambers funeral home by a son of the owner without the company's knowledge. Among the client names contained in the vouchers and identified by prostitutes and escort operators are government officials, locally based U.S. military officers, businessmen, lawyers, bankers, congressional aides, and other professionals. Editors of the Times said the newspaper would print only the names of those found to be in sensitive government posts or positions of influence. There is no intention of publishing names or facts about the operation merely for titillation, said Wesley Pruden, managing editor of the Times. The office of U.S. Attorney Jay Stevens, former deputy White House counsel to President Reagan, is coordinating federal aspects of the inquiry, but refused to discuss the investigation or grand jury action. Several former White House colleagues of Mr. Stevens were listed among clients of the homosexual prostitution ring, according to the credit card records, and those persons have confirmed that the charges were theirs. Mr. Stevens' office, after first saying it would cooperate with the Times inquiry, withdrew the offer late yesterday and also declined to say whether Mr. Stevens would recuse himself from the case because of possible conflicts of interest. At least one highly placed Bush administration official and a wealthy businessman who procured homosexual prostitutes from the escort services operated by the ring are cooperating with the investigation. Several sources said, among clients who charged homosexual prostitution services on major credit cards over the past 18 months are Charles Dutcher, former associate director of presidential personnel in the Reagan administration, and Paul Balak, labor secretary and Elizabeth Dole's political personnel liaison to the White House. In the 1970s, Mr. Dutcher was a congressional aide to former Representative Robert Bauman, Maryland Republican, who resigned from the House after he admitted having engaged in sexual liaisons with teenage male prostitutes. Mr. Dutcher also worked on the staff of Vice President Dan Quayle when he represented an Indiana district in the House. Another charge was discovered against the credit card of a former White House staffer who prepared the president's daily news summary in the Reagan administration. Todd Blodgett said he had not made the charge. One of the ring's big spending clients is Craig Spence, Washington socialite and international trade consultant, according to documents and interviews with operators and prostitutes who say they engaged in sexual activities with Mr. Spence. Mr. Spence spent upwards of $20,000 a month for male prostitutes who provided sex to him and his friends, said to include military personnel who also acted as his bodyguards. It was Mr. Spence who arranged the nocturnal tour of the Reagan White House. Repeated attempts to reach Mr. Spence by telephone, fax machine, and personal visits to his home were unsuccessful. Credit card vouchers confirm that Mr. Spence charged thousands of dollars on American Express and Visa cards, sometimes making $600 charges against his cards several times a day, drawn on behalf of an escort service called Professional Services Incorporated. Professional Services is one of several umbrella companies used by operators supplying male prostitutes as escorts, as advertised in Washington tabloid newspapers and the telephone yellow pages. Members of major news organizations also procured escort services from the ring, credit card documents show. These include Stanley Mark Tapscott, who was an assistant managing editor of the Washington Times. Before joining the Times, Mr. Tapscott worked for the Office of Personnel Management in the Reagan administration. Managers of the escort ring said that a few women were used for clients who called with specific requests, but that the regular stable was altogether male. The documents show that a number of clients, lawyers, doctors, and business executives, used corporate credit cards to procure escort services, and that a number of military officers from the United States and allied countries, including one foreign officer, using a Department of Defense credit card, charged male escort services. Those interviewed by the Times confirmed there were blackmail attempts by male prostitutes who wanted money and other favors to protect clients' secret sexual lives. Clients interviewed say a February 28th police raid on a house at 6004 Northwest 34th Place was set off by reports of blackmail and possible credit card fraud and complaints by district hotel operators about prostitution activities. In the raid, spearheaded by the Washington Field Office of the U.S. Secret Service, authorities found a telephone switchboard operation serving a half dozen homosexual escort services. Secret Service agents and district police vice investigators confiscated financial records, as well as ledgers, photos, diaries, telephone records, Rolodexes, and client lists of the prostitution network during the raid, and with subsequent subpoenas issued by D.C. Superior Court. Although the confiscated material was turned over to district police on the scene, witnesses and law enforcement agents say the Secret Service kept one box of files containing names and other information about high-level government officials who were clients of the male escort business. District police officials say that, to their knowledge, this is the first time the Secret Service has ever become involved in such a raid in this area. Initially, the Secret Service denied it was involved in the raid, but after a second raid of the 34th Place house on May 18th, the agency acknowledged its involvement in the investigation. Secret Service spokesman Bob Snow said the agency participated in the search and seizure operation because of its jurisdiction over credit card fraud. "We come into such operations usually at the request of a U.S. attorney. If the fraud involves $10,000 or more, we are not involved in any local prostitution investigation," Mr. Snow said. Witnesses to the February raid said 12 Secret Service agents in blue parkas entered the house and spent several hours collecting and removing boxes of files. Federal and district investigators have since interrogated several prostitutes working for the ring, as well as clients of the homosexual escort services operating under such names as Jovan, Man to Man, Metrodate, Ultimate Models, and Ultimate First Class. In addition to credit card fraud, the investigation is said to be focused on illegal interstate prostitution, abduction and use of minors for sexual perversion, extortion, larceny, and related illicit drug trafficking and use of prostitutes and their clients. One of the chief operators of Professional Services Incorporated and a regular client of the service speculated in separate interviews that the investigation would be restricted because big names were involved. Henry Vinson, the operator, said a high-level official is going to try to block the investigation and may succeed, said Mr. Bullock, the Labor Secretary's liaison to the White House. Mr. Vinson said he believes a highly placed federal official, whom he would not name, is working to derail the investigation, but he would not elaborate. Authorities have been investigating possible credit card fraud by the ring since last fall. As early as last October, 9 months before the police raid at 34th Place, Mr. Bullock was interviewed by investigators about grand larceny he said was committed against him by a male escort named Jason Michael Manos. According to Mr. Bullock, who first procured homosexual prostitutes from the network in June 1988, several clients, including himself, were blackmailed by the prostitutes. Operators of the ring told the Times that videotapes, audio tapes, and still photographs were made of sex acts performed by clients and the callboys, including perverted acts. Documents show that customers were charged for videotapes from the operations. In an attempt to hide the nature of credit card charges for some clients, professional services billed them for innocuous items such as a cremation urn or prayer cards. One of the ring's credit card processing companies was established by Robert Chambers, a funeral director whose family owns Chambers Funeral Home. Mr. Chambers, who declined to be interviewed, was said to have arranged with the Sovereign Bank in Silver Spring to establish the sub-merchant account in the Chambers Funeral Home credit accounts in the name Professional Services Incorporated. It is through this sub-merchant account that credit card vouchers and checks were processed from the mail escort services. Following the February 28th police raid on the 34th Place residence, Chambers Funeral Home officials, at the request of W.W. Chambers, the patriarch of the family business, canceled the unauthorized professional services account, according to the company comptroller. Robert Chambers was fired by his father from the company at the time. Mr. Vinson, professional services callboy dispatcher, is a trained mortician who also once worked for the clerk of the U.S. House of Representatives. Within 24 hours, another article was published. This time the headline read, "Power Brokers Serve Drugs, Sex at Parties Bugged for Blackmail." Craig Spence, an enigmatic figure who threw glittery parties for key officials of the Reagan and Bush administrations, media stars, and top military officers, bugged the gatherings to compromise guests, provided cocaine, blackmailed some associates, and spent up to $20,000 a month on male prostitutes, according to friends, acquaintances, and records. The 48-year-old D.C. power broker has been linked to a homosexual prostitution ring currently under investigation by the U.S. Attorney's Office. Mr. Spence's influence appeared unlimited, aptly demonstrated by his ability to arrange midnight tours of the White House, according to three persons who said they took part in those tours. "It was a show the flag time for Craig Spence," said one person who went on a July 3, 1988 tour that included two male prostitutes. "He just wanted everyone to know just how damn powerful he was," said the person. "When we were strolling through the White House at 1 o'clock in the morning, we were believers." One man who was on the tour but asked not to be named for fear it would damage his business said it was cleared by a uniformed Secret Service guard whom the man had seen attending Mr. Spence's parties as a bodyguard. For once in his life, Craig was doing something nice. "We just thought, neat, we get a free tour of the White House," the man said. Another person on the tour said the group walked through all the public areas of the White House and even took pictures of ourselves in the barber's chair. After arriving in Washington in the late 1970s, Mr. Spence was hosting parties during the early Reagan years, attended by, among others, journalists Eric Severide, Ted Koppel, and William Safire, former CIA Director William Casey, the late John Mitchell, Attorney General in the Nixon administration, conservative activist Phyllis Schlafly, Ambassador James Lilly, and General Alfred Gray, the Commandant of the Marine Corps. Arnaud de Borchgrave, editor-in-chief of The Times, went to dinner once at Mr. Spence's home to honor Mr. Lilly. Efforts to reach Mr. Spence in the past week were unsuccessful. He contacted the Washington Times yesterday in response to a telefaxed message, but hung up when queried about his activities. According to many current and former friends, Mr. Spence was a dangerous friend to cultivate. Several former associates said his house on Wyoming Avenue was bugged and had a secret two-way mirror, and that he attempted to ensnare visitors into compromising sexual encounters that he could then use as leverage. One man described having a limousine sent to his home by Mr. Spence and being brought to a gathering at which several young men tried to become friendly with him. "I didn't bite. It's not my inclination," the man said. But he used his homosexual network for all it was worth. A business associate of Mr. Spence, who was on the White House tour, said, "He was blackmailing people. He was taping people and blackmailing them." One former friend said he saw an 8-foot-long two-way mirror overlooking the library of Mr. Spence's home, which he said he was later told was used for spying on guests. Georgetown University law professor Richard Gordon said he was a close friend of Mr. Spence's until his behavior began deteriorating quite markedly. Mr. Gordon recalled being at a gathering at Mr. Spence's home and having a conversation with veteran NBC and CBS correspondent Liz Trotta. "We were sitting in a corner, talking about our mutual concern about Craig's physical condition. He came down later and said he had been listening to us and didn't appreciate it at all," Mr. Gordon said. Ms. Trotta, contacted in New York City yesterday, confirmed Mr. Gordon's comments and said it was one in a series of incidents in which she began to question Mr. Spence's emotional and physical stability. "He was fragmenting right before our eyes," she said. "I was very concerned about him." One former Reagan administration official who worked at the U.S. Information Agency and is an open homosexual said he went to private parties at Mr. Spence's home and saw a great deal of recording and taping equipment. "It was my clear impression that the house was bugged," he said. Another man, an Air Force sergeant who worked for Mr. Spence as a bodyguard, said, "The house was definitely bugged. I can't say what he was doing with the information. I don't know that, but he was recording what occurred there." Several others confirmed that Mr. Spence had bragged on several occasions that he had had his house bugged and that conversations between guests often had been overheard. They said Mr. Spence often would come down late to parties he hosted and told close associates that he had been listening to what was being said about him. Several people also said Mr. Spence boasted about getting control of the million-dollar home on Wyoming Avenue by blackmailing clients in Japan. William Harbin, a former U.S. Foreign Service official who worked for Mr. Spence in the mid-1980s, said, "He pretty much blackmailed a Japanese client. He had represented this firm in Washington, a policy study group. The Japanese put up the money for Spence to buy a big house on Wyoming Avenue," Mr. Harbin said. "I heard he later had a quarrel with them because he was really using this house to advance his own purposes, not for the Japanese. But he threatened to expose that they had transferred the money illegally, so it made them back down." Another longtime friend confirmed that Mr. Spence bragged about the Wyoming Avenue deal, saying he had beaten a very rich, old-line Japanese family. Secret Service spokesman Bob Snow, when asked yesterday for records about Mr. Spence's visits to the White House, said only the White House counsel could authorize release of the material. Boyden Gray, the White House counsel, said he did not know why Mr. Snow referred the Times to him, adding that he was unaware that his office was required to release such information. I just don't know anything about that, Mr. Gray said. But maybe there's something I don't know about. Mr. Spence's guests soured on his hospitality when his darker behavior emerged. A case in point is his relationship with former U.S. Attorney Joseph DiGenova. According to Mr. DiGenova, he attended a few of Mr. Spence's parties, both as U.S. Attorney, and after he left the government to enter private practice. He eventually traveled to Japan last December on a business trip with Mr. Spence and Wayne Bishop, chairman of the Washington law firm of Bishop, Cook, Purcell, and Reynolds, where Mr. DiGenova works. When I got back from Japan, some anonymous person suggested that he, Mr. Spence, might be using cocaine. Well, of course, my antenna went up right away, and I checked those rumors out, and found much to my surprise that people suspected the worst, Mr. DiGenova said. At that point, he severed his relationship with Mr. Spence. When you compared it to his other eccentric behavior, it made sense. I had no evidence whatsoever, he said. Mr. DiGenova said he never took his concern that Mr. Spence might be using drugs to authorities. Others interviewed said they witnessed drug use and other crimes at parties thrown by Mr. Spence, but also never shared their observations with law enforcement officials. The saga of Mr. Spence, described by one friend as Washington's Jay Gatsby, began unraveling when federal and D.C. police raided a male prostitution ring in Northwest Washington and discovered credit card vouchers signed by Mr. Spence and others. But for several years, even as publications such as the New York Times were describing Mr. Spence as Washington's ultimate power broker, acquaintances noticed bizarre behavior. Mr. Spence was generous with cocaine at his parties, according to several people who said they witnessed drug use at the exclusive Colorama House. I know he was a coke freak, said the business associate who was on the White House tour. A lot of people saw it. His behavior spoke for itself. Several friends said Mr. Spence bragged that U.S. military personnel, for whom he had built a gymnasium in El Salvador, had smuggled cocaine back to him when they returned to the United States. I heard he was selling drugs or smuggling drugs into the country from El Salvador, said a friend who worked closely with Spence. He went down there two or three times, or maybe more. He was trying to interest a Japanese firm with buying a fishery in El Salvador. Others said the drugs came from a more mundane source, mid-level dealers in Northwest Washington. How a man whom even his closest friends describe as a flawed, malevolent personality managed to court Washington's biggest names is a quintessential Washington story. Even intimate friends said his depiction of his background was as shifting as his guest list. What can be confirmed is that he attended Syracuse University and worked as a journalist with ABC in Southeast Asia during the Vietnam War. One former friend, who became acquainted with Mr. Spence in Tokyo, said that the latter had a falling out with ABC News because of his political views. A former friend said Mr. Spence was a hardline conservative and was opposed to what he described as the liberal treatment of the news by the network. Mr. Spence made good contacts in Japan and among Chinese expatriates, often bragging of his close association with former Japanese Prime Minister Yasuhiro Nakasone, and appearing in public with a Chinese businessman who once served as an unofficial representative of Communist China in Washington, sources said. The businessman said that he did not know exactly what work Spence did, but that he often bragged about his contacts with Japanese businessmen and political leaders, particularly Mr. Nakasone. He described Spence as strange, saying that he often boasted that he was working for the CIA, and on one occasion said he was going to disappear for a while because he had an important CIA assignment. According to the businessman, Spence told him that the CIA might double-cross him, however, and kill him instead, and then make it look like a suicide. The businessman also said he attended a birthday bash for Roy Cohn at Spence's house. He said CIA Director William Casey was also at the party. One time, Spence stormed into another party with a big white hat and an entourage of security guards. It was all rather bizarre. Craig Spence's trump card in courting the rich and famous apparently was his access to high-ranking Orientals at a moment when Japan was flowering as an economic giant and relations with China were thawing. Craig had an interest in the Japanese economy, said Richard Gordon. He was very interested in breaking through the bureaucratic level and getting people to come to seminars. He developed a kind of genuine and effective influence among important doers and thinkers in Washington and from New York, Gordon said. I met some interesting senators and representatives at his parties. He was doing extensive business with Japan in the early 1980s, some of which former Reagan administration officials said appeared to violate trade laws. Gordon claimed he warned Mr. Spence of the need to be registered as a lobbyist, and documents show that in January 1985, he became a registered agent lobbying for Japanese businesses. A very generous January 1982 New York Times profile of Craig Spence was headlined, "Have Names, We'll Open Right Doors." The article quoted a Washington Post columnist in 1980 saying of Mr. Spence, "Not since Ethel Kennedy used to give her famous Hickory Hill seminars for great minds of our times during the days of Camelot has anyone staged seminars successfully on a continuing social basis in Washington." That's what Craig Spence has been doing. He was described in the New York Times as something of a mystery man who dresses in Edwardian dandy style, a former television correspondent who now wears many hats, including international business consultant, party host, registered foreign agent, and something called research journalist. Henry Vinson ran the largest homosexual prostitution ring ever discovered in Washington, D.C. It catered to intelligence officers, powerful politicians, prominent businessmen, and important figures in the media. Press quickly dubbed him the D.C. Madam, which would become a recycled tactic used against Deborah Jean Palfrey during a sex scandal involving another escort agency in Washington, D.C., called Pamela Martin & Associates. Vinson found the courage to tell his story with the help of the brilliant investigative journalist Nick Bryant in the form of the book Confessions of a D.C. Madam. In the first chapter of the book, he explains experiencing an incredible sense of déjà vu when he first heard the media brand her as the D.C. Madam. The media had branded me a D.C. Madam years before Deborah Jean Palfrey was given that distinction. Although the media's reportage on me had been distorted and derisive, it's indeed accurate that at the sprite age of 29, I was the proprietor of the largest gay escort service in Washington, D.C. The Washington Post's skewed coverage of me was due to the fact that the newspaper, by either commission or omission, took its cue from the federal government, which manufactured a labyrinth of lies about my circumstances. The federal government also unleashed a reign of terror on me and my family. In fact, the feds even threatened to indict my elderly mother, and one newspaper reported that Secret Service agents actually kicked down the front door of my sister's home and held my brother-in-law at gunpoint. Feds felt it was imperative to ensure my silence by any means necessary because I had witnessed events that invariably would have ignited seismic political cataclysms. Political cataclysms that had the potential to jeopardize the administration of George H.W. Bush and the subsequent Bush dynasty. Given my former incarnation as a D.C. madam, I followed the tribulations, trial, and death of Deborah Jean Palfrey with intense interest. I marveled at the striking similarities between our cases, and I empathized with her dire circumstances. On Larry King Live, Miss Palfrey dispensed a warning to Americans about their corrupt political system. Think about it a bit, and you'll come to the conclusion that we have come to, that there are possible people who have used the service, who have become the subjects and targets of blackmail. I'm uncertain if Miss Palfrey witnessed the blackmailing of politicians firsthand, but I was certainly privy to the blackmailing of politicians and sundry power brokers. If the Department of Justice, the Secret Service, and the Washington Post had not been fixated on covering up the facts and individuals enmeshed in my case, Americans would have learned the unsavory truth that blackmail is endemic to their political system. The sexual escapades of the DC elite are vastly different than the infidelities of the average citizen, thus their susceptibility to blackmail. Before Miss Palfrey's trial, she imparted flurries of sound bites to the media, intimating that she was the custodian of too many secrets, and the government would be unlocking a Pandora's box if it prosecuted her. Palfrey told ABC, "I am sure as heck not going to federal prison for one day, let alone, you know, 4 to 8 years here, because I'm shy about bringing in the deputy secretary of whatever, not for a second. I'll bring every last one of them in if necessary. I, like Miss Palfrey, thought that the secrets I had amassed over the years would discourage the government from prosecuting me. After the Secret Service's initial raid and ransacking of my home prior to being indicted, I remarked to a reporter, somebody set us up because they were scared about what we knew about high government officials. And anyways, if they do try to indict me, I'll have some good stories to tell. I was a mere 29 years old when I dispensed that quote, and regrettably, I had the aplomb and inexperience of youth, which is an extremely flawed tandem when locking horns with the federal government. I woefully underestimated the ruthlessness and absolute power of my adversary. Miss Palfrey followed through on her threat and attempted to unfurl her secrets. She presented ABC News with 43 pounds of printed pages that contained the phone numbers of the thousands of Johns who frequented her escort service over the years. Miss Palfrey had no idea of the names accompanying the vast majority of the phone numbers, and she hoped that ABC would decipher that information. She felt that the potentially pyrokinetic scoop she handed to ABC would force the government on the defensive and impede its zealous crusade to imprison her. But her counteroffensive spectacularly backfired. ABC refused to follow through on the revelations contained in the 43-pound printout. ABC correspondent Brian Ross announced that, based on our reporting, it turned out not to be as newsworthy as we thought in terms of the names, even though it would emerge that Palfrey's patrons included, for starters, a U.S. senator, a Department of Defense consultant who developed the shock and awe doctrine deployed in Iraq, and State Department official Randall Tobias. In a stunning demonstration of hypocrisy, Tobias was the Agency for International Development's Director of Foreign Assistance, and he managed agencies that required the foreign recipients of AIDS assistance to condemn prostitution. The federal government subjected both me and Miss Palfrey to a crucible that was designed to ensure our silence or ultimately crush us. They just destroy you on every level, financially, emotionally, psychologically, Miss Palfrey reportedly said of federal prosecutors. In the case of Miss Palfrey, the U.S. Attorney for the District of D.C. smacked her with a 14-count RICO indictment that included money laundering, racketeering, and using the mail for illegal purposes in connection with a prostitution ring, and she was facing a bewildering 55 years behind bars. RICO was an acronym for the Racketeer Influenced and Corrupt Organizations Act, and it was originally designed to dismantle the mafia, as RICO allows for mob bosses to be tried for crimes that were sanctioned on their behalf. Miss Palfrey was merely running an escort service, so it seems that the RICO Act was prosecutorial overkill in her circumstances, unless, of course, prosecutors felt it was imperative to leverage her silence. I, too, was merely running an escort service, but the U.S. Attorney for the District of D.C. walloped me with a 43-count RICO indictment. I was potentially staring at 295 years behind bars. I was also looking at the possibility of a $2 million fine, and as I've previously mentioned, the feds were threatening to indict my mother. Although my case and Miss Palfrey's share numerous parallels, a major point of divergence is the proficiency of our respective attorneys. D.C.-based attorney Montgomery Sibley represented Miss Palfrey, and Greta Van Susteren represented me. Mr. Sibley vigorously defended Miss Palfrey, but he had to contend with the Fed's judicial chicanery and sleight of hand. Miss Palfrey's initial trial judge had authorized Mr. Sibley's subpoenas of the White House, State Department, CIA, etc., and he also authorized subpoenas for AT&T, Sprint, T-Mobile, and Altel, which would have mandated those carriers to provide Miss Palfrey with the names and addresses of the individuals who contacted her escort service. Inexplicably, Miss Palfrey's initial trial judge was replaced by a judge who quashed Mr. Sibley's subpoenas en masse and thereby eviscerated the defense's case. At the outset of my case, my attorney Greta Van Susteren seemed very committed to a vigorous defense on my behalf, and she deployed a nearly identical tactic as Mr. Sibley. She filed an 11-page motion to mandate the release of my clientele list that the government had previously seized from me. Miss Van Susteren argued that the names of my patrons should be released because if the government's assertion was accurate, and my escort service was, in actuality, a prostitution ring, my clients aided and abetted a criminal enterprise. But the Assistant U.S. Attorney for D.C. vehemently contested Miss Van Susteren's motion with a remarkably disingenuous argument. He contended that the names of my patrons shouldn't be made public because the U.S. Attorney's Office feared the intimidation of government witnesses due to the embarrassing nature of my case. My trial judge sided with the prosecution and barred the public disclosure of my clientele. After my trial judge acquiesced to the U.S. Attorney's Office, Miss Van Susteren started to change her tune, and she urged me to take the government's plea bargain. By then, my family and I had been subjected to a relentless campaign of terror, and I faced life in prison. I felt as if the feds were wielding the sword of Damocles over my head. At Miss Van Susteren's behest, I accepted the government's plea bargain, and I was sentenced to 63 months in federal prison. The feds also included a caveat that wasn't overtly stated in my plea agreement. My 5-year sentence was based on the contingency that I not divulge a word about the particulars of my case to the media. Although I'm uncertain whether or not it's a mere coincidence, I should point out that the individuals who were instrumental in the cover-up of my case experienced significant upward mobility. Miss Van Susteren now has her very own television show on Fox, and the U.S. Attorney for the District of D.C., who imprisoned me and ensured my silence, is now a vice president of the Raytheon Corporation, one of the world's largest defense contractors. After I was gagged and banished to a federal prison, I've been told that the government sealed in perpetuity a myriad of documents in my case. I'm aware of at least 3 individuals who have attempted to unseal my documentation, but the government has successfully rebuffed each of them. Conversely, Miss Palfrey opted to fight City Hall, but the U.S. Attorney for D.C. triumphed in her case, and she was found guilty on all counts. As Miss Palfrey awaited sentencing, she purportedly committed suicide. Miss Palfrey's death is mired in conjecture, rumor, and innuendo, and the internet is rife with speculation that Miss Palfrey's suicide was indeed a murder. Miss Palfrey publicly stated on a handful of occasions that she would never commit suicide, which buttresses the contentions that she was murdered. One of these occasions happened in 2007 during an interview on the Alex Jones Show not long before her death.
Well, from what I gather, and I'll try to compress it as much as I possibly can because it's a very convoluted and detailed story, but from what I gather, I was under investigation more or less, and it could have been prior to this, but more or less from March or so of 2004 until last October 4th of 2006 when there was a raid conducted on my home, a search warrant executed upon my home. Now, I'm using the word investigated or investigation rather loosely here. It does not appear to have been an investigation into prostitution-related services or activities since, oh, by the way, prostitution is not a federal crime. It is left for the states in the lower state courts, I might say, to adjudicate. However, what appears
it's a local vice issue.
It's a local vice issue, absolutely. What appears to have taken place, however, is some sort of a gathering of evidence on Deborah Jean Palfrey, sort of a la J. Edgar Hoover style. Personal information, financial information, and the like. There does not appear to have been any sort of actual investigation, from what I gather, and I am 10 months into this now, and I've gone through a civil process, now I'm into a criminal process.
Well, I'll tell you, from what I've seen in the past, and just instinctively I've seen this before, they may have been tracking what was going on with your business to use that without your knowledge for higher-ups to actually blackmail people.
That's kind of my thinking, or something as nefarious as that.
Mm-hmm.
Or something as nefarious as that.
Absolutely.
That's exactly what we believe has occurred.
Ah, you don't see that in the media. Please continue.
No, you sure don't, and you're very on point with that observation. Why did they pull the trigger on October 4 last year? I mean, I could still be ongoing here, except I did a couple of unusual things last year, which I think whoever they are that were watching me became very concerned. Last July, I put my house of 15, 16 years on the market. Simultaneously, within a few weeks, early August of last year, I closed my business, the one in question, Pamela Martin and Associates, which I had operated nonstop for 13 years. In some people's eyes, it would have been perceived as an unexpected move.
So they thought maybe you were planning to kind of leave the mafia, and they don't ever let you leave, kind of.
You know that's another very good observation. You know, as long as the status quo was ongoing, because I was so reliable, I was so dependable, I ran such a nice service, sort of in the style of the Mayflower Madam from New York from back in the 1980s. No drugs. We paid our taxes every year, believe it or not. Everything was just so nicely done, and then I all of a sudden quit.
Yeah, they got paranoid, and then the wicked flee when none pursueth, basically because they were paranoid. Now they've triggered what they were worried about. Or perhaps they were trying to trigger a chain of events because they had assessed you to cause you to stand up and fight back against them, because they had assessed you psychologically to run now a massive blackmailing operation. Stay with us. We'll be right back with our guest. Well, look, I mean, she's already dropped the atomic bomb on him. She's already released the numbers.
Yeah, I have, and not to be concerned, I have no intention of letting anyone buy me off or make any kind of a deal with me.
And you're not planning to commit suicide.
And I'm not planning to commit suicide either.
The fact that you're so visible really protects you going on Larry King and other big shows, but you want to put it on record that you're not planning to commit suicide?
No, I'm not planning to commit suicide. I'm planning to go into court on April 7th if indeed we do have the trial, and I plan on defending myself vigorously, and I plan on exposing the government in ways that, you know, I do not think they want me to expose them. I want them to explain to me in open court why they came after me.
Joining me now from Austin, Texas, the well-known radio host himself, the conspiracy theorist and documentary filmmaker Alex Jones. Alex interviewed Deborah Palfrey in March of this year when she told him what you just heard, that she would never commit suicide. So, Alex, welcome. What do you think? Do you believe this to be as the authorities say it is?
Geraldo, first off, thanks for having me on. She was a very nice lady, very genteel. There's no doubt in my mind that she was murdered. Let me just go through some of the basic evidence. She told me repeatedly on my radio show, and those interviews are posted at Infowars.com in full, that she would never kill herself, that she wasn't planning to kill herself. I pressed her during breaks in front of the board ops. I said, listen, this is dangerous. You've got to say who these people were. Do you know? And she said, well, I'm not going to say. I just want this all to end. And I said, you've got to say who it was, or you're not safe. She said, listen, I'll never kill myself. If they claim that, I was murdered. So we have a tape of her saying she wouldn't commit suicide. Now, NBC in Florida, where she had a condo, is reporting that one of her friends, who was the manager of the high-rise condos, and he's on tape saying 2 days before she was killed, before she died, she left to her mother's and said, look, I'm being followed. I think there's a contract out on me. I'm not going to kill myself. This is on tape. Then you look at Brandi Britton. She was facing 6 months in jail last year, shot her mouth off, Ms. Palfrey said, the D.C. madam said, and said, I'm going to talk about who my Johns are. This is hypocritical. She was a professor. You know, she had a psychology degree. She was saying, this is hypocritical. I'm going to tell who my Johns were, and then she hangs herself. Number one, Geraldo, you covered a lot of criminology. You know, women don't normally hang themselves. First, one of her girls kills herself. Now she kills herself.
They take pills.
Exactly. And on top of it, in fact, 90% of women take pills. That's the way they do it. Now, men shoot themselves and hang themselves. Now, on top of it, her mother said she was happy, saying she was going to fight it.
Alex, let me take a break. Stand by right there. I have Judge Pirro and Kim Guilfoyle also right back.
Henry Vinson concludes his thoughts on fellow D.C. Madam Deborah Jean Palfrey, explaining that, moreover, after Miss Palfrey's demise, an Orlando affiliate of CBS interviewed the building manager of the Park Lake Towers in Orlando, where Miss Palfrey owned a condo. The building manager disclosed that he had talked to Miss Palfrey just 3 days before her lifeless body was found in her mother's aluminum shed. Jean Palfrey was a class act, said the building manager. Her way out of this world certainly would not have been in an aluminum shed attached to a mobile home in Tarpon Springs, Florida. The manager also discussed a disturbing conversation he had with Miss Palfrey. She insinuated that there is a contract out for her, and I fully believe they succeeded. The Washington Post was quick to declare that Miss Palfrey had taken her own life, despite the possibility of indications to the contrary. I mention the latter points because the Washington Post reported a myriad of details about my case that were inaccurate, despite the possibility of indications to the contrary, or solely based on the word of federal law enforcement officials. Although I'm unwilling to speculate whether or not the death of Miss Palfrey was a suicide or a murder, I feared for my life when I was a D.C. madam due to the threats discharged by government officials and also by individuals who were reportedly affiliated with the government. As Miss Palfrey and I regrettably discovered, Americans have a collective naivete about D.C. sex scandals, believing that they are the mere dalliances and moral failings of a handful of individuals. Americans have a great difficulty accepting that many of our politicians are endowed with a potent alchemy of power, arrogance, and lust, an alchemy that fluently translates into extramarital affairs or illicit sexual encounters. Unfortunately, the federal government has a greater dexterity to cover up scandals and crimes that lend themselves to blackmail in D.C. due to the fact that the Capitol's law enforcement is exclusively controlled by various branches of the federal government, the U.S. Attorney for D.C., who prosecutes all D.C. crimes, is appointed by the president. The FBI and Secret Service are also minions of the executive branch, and Congress controls the budget of D.C.'s Metropolitan Police Department. I would be remiss if I didn't mention that the D.C. Press Corps played an integral role in the cover-up surrounding my case. I've already alluded to the fact that the Washington Post aided and abetted the cover-up by tainting its reportage with the government's top spin. The Washington Post was by no means the only media outlet that covered up the factual circumstances of my case. Perhaps a number of the high flyers in the D.C. Press Corps aren't mindful of the blackmail that has usurped the American political process, but I'm also aware of nationally recognized pundits who are potentially compromised themselves because they were patrons of my escort service. I initially thought that if I adhered to the Faustian pact I made with the government and remained mute about the Fed's labyrinth of lies and served my time, I would be permitted to live out the balance of my life in peace. The government and media have continued to persecute me. Bloggers on the internet have also taken their cue from the government and the media, and the internet is rife with lies about me too. Although I've transformed myself into a legitimate and successful businessman and am a poster boy for reformed felons, I've been inexorably stalked by a wayward federal judiciary and a pernicious 20-year assault on my character. Consequently, I have finally decided to rupture my silence and expose the illicit skullduggery I witnessed as a D.C. madam, and also the Byzantine machinations that the government fabricated to ensure my silence and incarcerate me. Henry Vinson refers to Craig Spence as the Prince of Darkness and considers him to have been a CIA asset with deep ties to the U.S. Secret Service, even revealing that Secret Service personnel served as his private security force 24 hours a day. The second time he was ever summoned to his home in D.C., Vinson claims to have met Lawrence E. King, who happened to run the Franklin Federal Credit Union in Omaha, Nebraska. Spence began quizzing Henry about his life, asking him what seemed to be heartfelt questions, when he stands up and gestures for him to follow. According to the book, Spence walked toward a large mirror that was situated on a living room wall, and then opened a closet door that was in the corner of his living room. He popped open a secret panel that was embedded in the closet, and he stepped into a small room that was behind the mirror. He cautiously paused at the threshold of the closet. Spence waved his right hand, signifying that I should follow him into the surreptitious room. The mirror on the living room wall was, in fact, a two-way mirror. In the room had a video camera on a tripod that was pointed toward the living room, and also a wall of video monitors. Spence leaned over one of the video monitors, and after tapping a few of its buttons, he replayed the concluding minutes of our conversation. At that moment, I felt shrink-wrapped by cellophane, and I found it difficult to breathe. As I silently stared at the monitor, Spence casually smiled and explained to me that his entire home was bugged for clandestine surveillance, and CIA operatives had installed the concealed video cameras throughout his house. He couldn't help himself from crowing that his surveillance equipment was state-of-the-art, and the camera that captured our conversations was embedded in the living room's thermostat. Spence then divulged that he blackmailed the rich and powerful. I remained stunned and speechless as I watched myself discussing my life and escort service on the video monitor, but after a few minutes, I started to swell with anger. However, I didn't express my anger to Spence, because at that moment, I was undeniably frightened of him, and I'm also not a confrontational person. Once Spence had flaunted his blackmail equipment, he dispensed a grave threat about the consequences if I uttered nary a word relating to his concealed cameras. He then dismissed me. Although Spence and King pressured him to procure underage boys, Vincent allegedly refused on moral grounds. At this meeting, when Spence and King were apparently high on cocaine, King revealed that he and Spence operated an interstate pedophile network that flew children coast to coast. King also discussed that he and Spence had a clientele of powerful pedophiles who actually took pleasure in murdering children. In fact, King seemed to be obsessed with the subject of murdering children. Henry writes that they attempted to coerce me into ensnaring children for them. King had previously mentioned that he flew children into D.C., and the escorts I employed confirmed that minors were in attendance at Spence's orgies. I had come to the horrifying conclusion that Spence and King operated an interstate pedophile network for their power broker cronies. But I absolutely refused to aid and abet their abuse of children, despite Spence's potential to blackmail me or perhaps even kill me. Their demands escalated into an inexorable crescendo. Spence and King finally demanded that I pluck destitute children off the streets of D.C. and deliver the children to them. One of the most important disclosures made by Henry Vinson was the story of what inevitably led to his downfall within the network, directly implicating ranking members at the highest levels of the United States government. Vinson claims that, in January 1989, I received a puzzling phone call from a woman who worked for the government accounting office. A patron of my escort service, Donald Gregg, had racked up recurrent credit card charges for funeral accessories with his government-issued MasterCard, and the GAO employee had numerous questions about the charges. I was caught off guard by her questions, so I was uncertain of the appropriate response. I ultimately advised her that the charges were of a personal nature, and I suggested that she contact Donald Gregg. Right after the GAO contacted me, I phoned Spence and told him about the particulars of the call. He replied that he would be in touch. Donald Gregg wasn't an average run-of-the-mill government apparatchik. He had been a CIA agent for 31 years, and he played an integral role in the Phoenix program, a nefarious CIA initiative that slaughtered over 25,000 South Vietnamese who were in many cases mistakenly thought to be collaborating with North Vietnam. When Gregg was soliciting gay escorts from me with his government-issued MasterCard, he served as Vice President George H.W. Bush's National Security Advisor, In 1983, Gregg had a secret meeting with CIA agent Felix Rodriguez and Vice President Bush in the White House, where the trio hatched a covert scheme to provide military aid to the Contras in Nicaragua, which ultimately morphed into Iran-Contra. CIA agent Rodriguez, too, had an infamous reputation because he had been a cog in the dark machinations of the Phoenix program, and he also helped hunt down Che Guevara in Bolivia and pilfered the watch from the dead Guevara as a trophy. Gregg and George H.W. Bush were old friends, and after the latter became president, he appointed Gregg to be the United States ambassador to South Korea. So Gregg was someone that the first Bush administration felt inclined to protect from the fact that he procured gay escorts on the government dime. Craig Spence hinted to the Washington Times that Donald Gregg had arranged his late-night tours at the White House. Gregg vehemently repudiated Spence's allegations as absolute bull. Indeed, Gregg didn't seem to hold Spence in high esteem. "It disturbs me that he can reach a slimy hand out of the sewer to grab me by the ankle like this," Gregg said of Spence. In the article, Gregg said that he had met Spence only once, but given the events that subsequently unfolded, "I'm inclined to believe that Spence and Gregg had more than one contact." 3 weeks or so following the phone call from the GAO, Spence summoned me to his condominium. I hadn't seen Spence in 2 months, and I was shocked by his physical deterioration. He was emaciated, and his complexion was ashen. I later learned that in addition to a crack addiction, he had contracted AIDS. After Spence ushered me into his house, he motioned to a couch that was in his living room. As I sat down, Spence seated himself on his chocolate sofa next to a man in his late 50s. He had balding black hair and brown round-framed glasses. He wore a blue pinstripe suit, white shirt, and a red tie. A miniature U.S. flag was pinned on his lapel. Spence introduced the man to me by his name and also disclosed his title. He was in the cabinet of George H.W. Bush. "I feel that the Bush administration had decided to pull out a big gun to eradicate any traces of Gregg's affinity for gay escorts, because Gregg had been so instrumental in Iran-Contra, and because he was en route to becoming the United States ambassador to South Korea." Spence had dropped the name of the cabinet member months earlier when he revealed that he routinely provided him with adolescent boys. At the time Spence dropped his name and his perverse predications, I thought his disclosure broached incomprehensible. I was fairly skeptical of it. But on the other hand, the vast majority of Spence's illicit activities seemed incomprehensible to me until I actually witnessed them. Our conversation focused on the GAO conundrum, and Spence and his friend quickly cut to the chase. They told me to write a letter to the GAO detailing blood studies I had conducted on behalf of Gregg. They explained that my occupation as a mortician would be a satisfactory device for the letter. I felt that I was potentially being set up for GAO embezzlement charges, and I balked at their demands. I replied that they certainly had the means and wherewithal to cover for Gregg, so the onus of covering up his extracurricular activities shouldn't fall on me. A man sitting next to Spence then uttered a question that I will never forget. "I can withstand a background investigation. Can you?" I responded, "Yes, I can withstand a background investigation." My response essentially concluded the 20-minute meeting. Spence was quite irate with me when I refused to write their letter, and he berated me as he showed me to the door. Unbeknownst to me, I would never see Spence again. I've since confirmed that Spence's friend was indeed in Bush's cabinet. He was obviously attempting to aid and abet Spence's cover-up of Gregg's extracurricular activities, even though Spence was free-falling in crack addiction. I have great difficulties believing that a man of immense power would put his cabinet position, career, and family on the line to help a degenerate crack addict, even if they were friends and the latter once provided him with adolescent boys. It only makes sense if the cabinet member was in the same shadowy network as Spence, or if that shadowy network had compromised him. Reportedly, Spence entered a downward spiral in the wake of the expose, increasingly involving himself with callboys and crack. He disappeared briefly, evading government agents who wanted to subpoena him to testify about the Vinson prostitution ring. Spence made headlines again after his arrest on July 31, 1989, at the Barbizon Hotel on East 63rd Street in Manhattan for criminal possession of a firearm and criminal possession of cocaine. In August 1989, during an 8-hour interview, Spence himself claimed that the surveillance equipment at his home had been set up by friendly intelligence agents. Rumors of Craig's ties to the CIA dated all the way back to his days as a Vietnam correspondent, and the CIA was largely considered to be one of the primary sources of his wealth by known acquaintances. On November 10, 1989, Spence was found dead and barricaded in room 429 of the Boston Ritz-Carlton. Multiple reports describe next to his body was a newspaper clipping about efforts to protect CIA agents from testifying before government agencies. His death would later be ruled a suicide from ingesting alcohol and antidepressants. The Washington Times reported that found hidden in a false ceiling in the bathroom were 7 small packets of Xanax, a prescription anti-anxiety drug, with one pill removed. In black felt tip marker, he had written on a mirror of his room, "Chief, consider this my resignation effective immediately. As you always said, you can't ask others to make a sacrifice if you are not ready to do the same. Life is duty. God bless America." As a postscript, he wrote, "To the Ritz, please forgive this inconvenience." In the end, as we stagger out of the heart of darkness, solemnly performing the Requiem for a Dream, we reveal the illicit subterfuge weaponized to exploit us. It's finally time we're conscious of the malevolent machinations designed to disarm us of our essential use of discernment. In an effort to regain our intellectual fortitude, we witness the true levers of power through a perpetual national sex scandal and the lurid account of the twisted tale of 2 D.C. madams, perfectly illustrating the unsavory truth that blackmail is endemic to the American political system.